Okay. So the first two cases are the dentist and the Baba. Okay, we're going to name these cases so don't get confused, okay? The dentist is not really a case with any sort of machloket or debate. He was a 36-year-old father of three who had a large stroke and became paralyzed on the left side. It was in the right hemisphere, and over a series of two or three days, he became more and more stuporous and comatose, and the CAT scan showed this increasing edema or swelling, so that the other side of the brain was going to be crushed, and it was clear that if nothing was going to be done, he was going to imminently die. And of course, everybody involved, there were no questions, wanted to be as aggressive as possible. And we did this very aggressive treatment, which is unusual to do, in which the neurosurgeons went in and did a craniectomy, took off a piece of the skull, and let the dead tissue sort of herniate outward, so it would take the pressure until everything settled down several days later, and then they put the skull back on. He gradually got better, went home, no speech, no use of his right hand, but, his right hand is through his left hand, and no use of his hand, and but never went back to work, but was very happy interacting with his children. So there were no ethical debates in that question. Everyone agreed we had to be totally aggressive in such a young man. Okay, now the Baba, almost identical case, okay? Except she's 87 years old, and she comes in with the identical right hemisphere stroke in a coma. I've just involved in this case lately. I haven't seen her myself. I've been involved because I've been asked for an opinion from these people who I know them, and they kept sending me the CAT scans by email. And I saw them 3 days in a row, and the same thing was happening. And they realized that there's no role for surgery, nor were they very interested in surgery. And they were asked by the ICU physicians, can we have a DNR? Because likely, likely this lady has a poor chance of survival, and with survival, she is going to be very, very debilitated. So they wanted to get a DNR from the family, do not intubate, do not do CPR, and I asked them, had there been any future wishes by the mother, and she had said, yes, I would. If ever I am going to die, I want to go quickly, I would never want to be in a debilitated state. But the husband felt that he could not abandon his wife, and that so he said no, he wants everything done short of surgery, and that's how it's left, and I can't give you a follow-up on that case. So my question to the rabbis is, why does the 87-year-old Baba not get as aggressive treatment as the 36-year-old dentist? That's my question. I'd like to hear your comments as well.
Of course. I don't have any mic, actually. This is just a recorder.
Do you want us to talk into the recorder?
It'll pick up. Okay,
pick up all of us? Rabbi Dr. Eddy has asked me to answer first. I had asked him to answer first. I would say, without knowing the details of the Bubba's full history, how sick she is otherwise, and assuming that this is an acute stroke, I would say that you should be just as aggressive with the Baba as you should be with the 36-year-old grandchild. However, if there were other underlying factors, sometimes the 36-year-old will have a better chance of recovery of overall, and the 87-year-old Baba might not. And she will end up being not just paralyzed on one side, but she will have no mental capacities of any significance, not from a halachic point of view, but from a what people would want to have if they could live. And if it was more chronic, this isn't day one, this is day 31. And the medical opinion is that there is really no hope that she will have any significant recovery, then I would advocate for a DNR for such a patient like that. So I think that there's a possible answer, yes, to be just like the grandchild, but there's a potential not to be like the grandchild. But I would also add the same thing could have applied to the grandchild. If it's now day 51 and there really is no hope that the grandchild will have any significant recovery and will be in a permanent vegetative state, with everything that Rabbi Dr. Reichman said about what that means, I'm not sure that you'd be required to do a you couldn't do a DNR for that 36-year-old as well. So intrinsically, there's no difference. I think you have to look at the medical facts to see whether there's a difference.
Yes, I think that's part of it also, because they realized her survival would be lower with surgery than his would be. So that's why surgery was off the table, although really, I think it was preference of neurosurgeons. They just wouldn't, they'd help us out in the case of that 36-year-old wouldn't. Anybody else want to make a comment about this case or anything? Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Can you back and forth again?
Rabbi Glatt, you made a case at the end of your talk, and Rabbi Reckon referred to the same topic, but the real problem I have, every time I go to these things, I think I'm going to learn the answers. I know I'm not going to learn the answers, but my problem is, at least I feel, at least maybe I don't know everybody, I'm certainly not a Talmud Chacham, I feel I don't have the postgame that really I can ask and feel that I'm getting, and in other words, the ones who are really involved, who really know the medical situation and all that, I don't have access, both as a physician, I think that I'm not always involved in that area anyway, and even for me to pick a proxy, I don't feel like, I don't know who to go to. That's a huge problem. I think that's number one. Number two,
okay. I just want to say one thing today. I have a short-term memory deficit. I'm going to forget what you asked for number one if you go number two. I heard a beautiful ma'isalah that was said over to Rav Shlomo Zalman. And a person came to him to ask him a very intricate, difficult shaila. And he goes up to Rav Shlomo Zalman, and Rav Shlomo Zalman is still alive, and he asked him the question, and Rav Shlomo Zalman started to pace and walk towards the window. And the person that's asking the question is really impressed. I stumped Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman pointed to come over here, brings him to the window, and he points to a house outside the window and says, that's where your Rav lives. Go and ask him this question. Very, very important. The local Rav, who knows the family, who knows the situation, is better qualified to either paskin the shaila or to go and ask his posek than a Rav Moshe or a Rav Shlomo Zalman is in the abstract. Rav Moshe or Shlomo Zalman, they're Rav Moshe or Shlomo Zalman. But they don't know the family situation. And these shailas should be asked to the local Rav. And the local Rav, trust me, if he's a good local Rav, as they all are, will ask halachically who he needs to ask. And that's who you should follow. That's my very humble opinion. It's wrong, I think, when people start going shopping and asking on a 1 or 2 minute telephone call to Rav David Feinstein or Rav Herschel Schachter or whoever they're asking, who don't know you, don't know the family dynamics, and you're as a layman often, not even as a medical doctor, not you personally, but the person who's asking the child doesn't know the medical facts. And the Rav Moshe, the Rav Schachter, they don't have the time to go speak to the doctor, and certainly the doctor isn't on the other end of the line. Whereas the local Rav has the opportunity to speak with the doctor sometime and get the medical information accurately. So my plea is that never bypass the local Rav. The local Rav, Asei L'chol Rav, is where it should start. And if the local Rav needs help, the local Rav knows where to ask for help.
The problem is often the local Rav is not willing. I think the point is that there is at least I get the feeling that some of them are stuck in the past and won't even speak to the doctor. In other words, you'll call the Rav, you'll give the situation, no, you have to do everything possible, and that's often what. So both as a proxy for me and that's the problem.
Yeah.
If
the local
Rav's that.
If the local Rav's abdicating his responsibility, then that's not a situation that's good. The local Rav is the most qualified person to be the both pastoral advisor and halachic advisor to the family.
But you point to a very complicated issue, and that is the notion that there are some rabbis who, because they don't feel comfortable with the medical information, may have difficulty integrating the medical information, will be machmir, will be stringent on the issues, simply because it may be too difficult for them to, they don't have the shoulders big enough to be able to be more lenient in cases where it generally could be more lenient. That's That's a very, very, very complex matter. And even the other issue which you allude to, you know, if it doesn't already exist, it probably will exist, a website which is www.findaheter.com, where you can have like a massive international list of which rabbis to go to. And because of the fact, and this is not a simple matter, because of the fact that a lot of the information is disseminated through the web and through other ways of communication, you pretty much know what certain rabbis are going to say in certain scenarios. You are going to try and seek out sort of the rabbis, whether consciously or subconsciously, that are in line with a position that you think is an appropriate position. This is a very complex theological matter, but the way halacha really is supposed to work is you're supposed to have a seilach harav, means you are really bound to that one rabbi, whatever their position may be. So a lot of people will shop around, they'll quote Rav Moshe for something which is convenient for them, but they'll ignore Rav Moshe for something which is not so convenient for them. So if you're going to hold like Rav Moshe, you have to hold like Rav Moshe across the board. So if you have a rav that holds a certain way, and your rav, you know, sometimes you may have to consult or ask your rav or be more insistent that your rav consult with other rabbanim, or you may have to go to other rabbanim within the community. But the reason why you won't find answers in this particular topic, perhaps more so than others, is because it really doesn't lend itself to classic guidelines and answers. It really is a very case-by-case thing. And I'm sure Rabbi Dr. Glatt, and I know I am, would be extremely hesitant to provide specifics on any of these cases for tremendous fear that they'll be extrapolated to in other cases inappropriately.
If you have a question, please hold up your hand and keep it up in the air. Okay, you go first, sir.
Thank you.
Keep your hand up. Take that one.
Yes, who knows what? I want to ask you about a particular case where the shopping is not to the lawyer but to the neurosurgeon. And this is a 3-year-old intact lawyer with a 1-year-old child who's perfectly healthy except that he had repeated attacks of brainstem dysfunction, which it turns out to be due to a benign angioma of the brainstem. These are lesions that are usually happenstance in the nervous system. They occur in non-eloquent areas. They don't do anything. But we find them on MRIs as incidents. In this case, the incident is in a very vital area. So he's had progressive attacks and now has double vision, which can be cured by one eye being patched, and he goes back to work. But he shopped around, and he has found 6 neurosurgeons who have all said, we can cure you. Now, I know for sure, I'm almost for sure as I can be, that this will be betraying the no-harm bin. He will end up crippled, double vision, incapacitated for work, and if he ever gets better again, it will be a miracle. I have very strongly advised, don't listen. But how do we get a decision in a situation like this where I really feel strongly that to go along with the mass opinion is to provide a harmful decision making. Now, I guess in this context is, do you do everything you can do that surgeons advise when somebody who's not a surgeon says that they'll advise?
I think that's
what surgeons need to do to make the best.
I think it's a very common question, and you certainly stated it in a very eloquent way. I believe that you as a physician halachically have the obligation to give the best and soundest advice that you can. And Shulchan Aruch recognizes, as I mentioned in my talk, that another physician who's also competent, I'm not talking about charlatans, I'm not talking about quacks, it's a board-certified neurosurgeon who has a different opinion than you. And all you're mechuyev to do is make the strongest case that you think you should be making to that patient. I myself have had this numerous times where I'll be the infectious disease consultant and the pulmonary consultant has a different opinion as to which antibiotics we should be using. And he's a competent, good pulmonologist. I'd like to think I'm a competent infectious disease person, and we have opposite ends of the spectrum recommendations. And the patient has the halachic autonomy to choose which one of us he wishes to go to. Says so Beferish and Shulchan Aruch. Now, if he's a third-year medical student, and I'm the Rosh Bahag of infectious diseases, then he doesn't have the right to listen to the third-year medical student over the chief of the department. But if it's two solid opinions, even though I could tell you, well, I published more, he published more, that's not halachic. That's already a choice that the patient has halachically the right to make who they wish to listen to. And if you made your case, and you did what you're supposed to, in Shemayim, you were 100% correct. Even though the patient didn't listen to you, you did what you're halachically supposed to do. You're not mechuyev to go and shoot the neurosurgeon. You're not even allowed to shoot the neurosurgeon.
In a conference involving all the people, 40 people involved, I made a statement, and it was really a paraphrase of what you said. I said, I think that if there's only a worst outcome, I would rather let him, and I said nature, but I really meant Rabbi Shalom, let him do it rather than me.
I think that's perfectly sound halachic advice.
And everybody laughed and thought it was very funny, but it's not funny at all.
But the truth is, that decision is really the patient's decision. Now, you obviously have a very strong opinion, but he is the one who has to either benefit from or suffer the consequences of this procedure. So you feel very strong about it, but you know what is essential is that he makes the decision with the right information and that his perspective is not clouded.
There is no absolute right information in this case.
That is correct. And also what is interesting in the age that we live in, there are indeed a higher echelon of surgeons that are doing vanguard procedures that are able to cure people that could never have been cured before. And it's possible that one of these surgeons might be the person who could isolate that focal tumor and remove that tumor. So the question is, do you as an individual have an obligation, he, who's the patient, who has this tumor, does he have an obligation to seek out that one surgeon in the world who could possibly do that procedure and find that cure? So that's completely within his right to do so. The fear is, though, is that he may have to ask a Shiloh whether it's permitted for him to undergo the surgery. So knowing the facts about the surgery, the risks of the surgery, so if he now is a healthy guy who just has double vision, but the surgeon says, you know, I might hit the brainstem on this and there's a 30% chance he might die on the table, then he may not even be halachically permitted to undergo the procedure. But if it's a procedure that he actually can halachically undergo where the risks are acceptable, then that falls squarely into his right to be able to decide whether to undergo the procedure or not.
We have six more people that expressed an interest in a question. I'm going to ask them to make the questions very brief and perhaps, we'll try not to go off on any tangents. And if we don't, go ahead, next person.
Yeah.
One, you know.
There's a big elephant in the room that no one's discussed, and we're facing... I don't know how many of you read the Bill Onmar, the 2,107 pages. I read excerpts of it. You got 1.5 billion cuts in hospice care. I just met this gentleman. He's a hospice. You got radiologists in the room. You got billions of dollars in cuts in imaging coming up. It seems to me a lot of decisions are going to be made for us rather than we're making decisions. I don't know how much do we have to deplete our resources. This is all theoretical discussions. They're all great theoretical discussions. How are the rabbis going to deal with this? How are the rabbis going to deal with a bank of responses that's been written up to now, which because of diminishing resources and inability to access, people don't have the funds, simply contradict what the rabbis up to now, whether Rabbi Moshe or other people have said. How are you going to do this? How are you going to deal with this going forward?
The reason why we're fighting over here is because this is going to be the bane of our existence for the next few decades. This is clearly the topic of the next decade, and we're all petrified about how to deal with this. The halachic fallout is going to be great. This is really, managed care from a few decades ago is not that dissimilar. This may be just a quantitative difference, not necessarily a qualitative difference. But it's really the scenario where the physician knows what's right for the patient, but the patient can't receive what the physician knows is right because of financial limitations or financial restrictions. And it reminds me of a case of a colleague of mine who was an OBGYN and had a woman who needed I think it was a uterine biopsy, couldn't do it as an outpatient because of anatomical restrictions, needed to get it in the OR. It was a young woman, was not approved, and they went back and forth and back and forth, for months, maybe even over a year. Finally, she showed up in an ER with some abdominal pain and had widespread metastatic uterine cancer. Now, is he at fault? Should he have done the procedure and taken the financial loss of doing the procedure? So that's a very difficult thing, and it basically would make practice completely untenable. And none of us would be able to practice. We'd have to close up shop in a week or two.
It's the halakhic contradiction.
Right.
A response that's been already written.
Well, it's not a halakhic contradiction. It's a question of who's going to pay for it. It's not halacha. Halacha doesn't change.
Well, are you thinking of something specific when you say that?
No, I mean, perhaps if someone said you have to do everything up to now and do everything for that patient, that's...
Oh, I see. Now no one's going to pay for it.
Right. Now the big elephant with whom the money comes in, and now you can't do it. And then, you know,
again, it's,
yes, if someone has costing, and this is the same exact situation you have to do it.
But I think I just want to use the terminology correctly. It's not a halachic contradiction. It's a question of who's going to pay for it. We have the same question already today. If a person requires nursing care and the insurance companies won't pay for that nursing care, so then they're a dinim of kibud av v'aim. The dinim are that you're mechuyev to pay for it from the father or the mother. You're not mechuyev min hadin to go and shell out from your own pocket. However, the Gemara also tells us that somebody who has the money to do so and doesn't, oy v'avoy to that person. Those are not halachic discussions on the medical point, they're halachic discussions on the financial point. And there's dinim that deal with that also. So there's dinim that would deal with a parent, there's dinim that would deal with a child. You have the same shilas already. A yeshiva has to charge tuition, but they can't afford to pay it. Are you going to send a child to public school? With an economic downturn, with health care reform, these shilas will become, as you correctly say, much more prominent in terms of the maisa. But it doesn't involve a halachic contradiction. The same halacha still applies.
Who has ticket number three? Go ahead.
One side is comment on that. I think that in countries that have less aggressive procedures and less number of procedures than the United States, if you look at the outcomes, they're almost identical. People in cardiologists, look at Canada, look at the US, totally different systems, identical or better outcomes in Canada. So that partially, I think, answers it. But the question I wanted to raise, and I just have to preface it by saying that A is false.
We're going to let these guys duke it out.
I wanted to preface it by saying there are occasions when I've had DNR patients where I've been more aggressive and had fights with relatives. But I want to take up your case of the Dr. Reitman, the patient in the emergency room with a ventilator who had DNR. I'll be honest, I put my cards on the table, I would have switched off that ventilator. And I... halakhically or non-halakhically, I try and make a distinction and involve the patients between prolonging life and prolonging death. So my question to the two panelists is that a halakhic distinction, and what are your concepts of prolonging life versus prolonging death?
I mean, that you really hit the nail on the head. That is really precisely the issue, prolonging life or prolonging death. And let me just, to your point in this particular case that you mentioned, there's at least one rabbinic opinion, Reb Chaim David Halevi, in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, who did say explicitly that you could remove a respirator from a patient, even if removing that respirator might cause the death of that individual, because he considered that particular case to be removing an impediment to death. This person was on the natural path to death. The respirator was like the sponges in the case of Hanina ben Trajan. You're allowed to remove the respirator to let nature take its course. But I will add that not the majority of rabbinic opinion didn't necessarily agree with that. But the major fork in the road really is whether the action that you are performing is itself something which will directly cause the death of the individual. And that's the fear that we struggle with. In terms of analysis of these issues.
Ticket number four, please.
Quick question. A Jewish patient walks into your ER in acute distress with a functional DNR, and what do you do? Because if you respect it, you're over a low time of Dom Reachman. And if you don't, you're going to jail.
This is actually I face this case, you face this case every day. So the analysis to this is very clear. We have an obligation of lo tamor al dam riacha. Let's say it's even an Orthodox Jewish patient, and the family says we don't want to resuscitate. However, if we would violate the law and we would go to jail as a result, we are not obligated to put ourselves in that situation and lose our livelihood, lose our ability to save other patients, to be a shaliach, to be a messenger to help save other patients, if it means if that would be the consequence. And the reason why that's true in these particular cases is because invariably, with some exceptions, in the majority of these cases, you will not be required to perform an act. Your involvement is a non-action or inaction. It's a shev v'al tase. So what are you doing when they come into the ER? You're standing there. You are frustrated. You want to intubate the patient. You think the patient legally, from a halachic perspective, needs to be intubated, but you're not. From a Jewish point, but you're not doing it. At the end of the day, you haven't done anything objectionable. You haven't committed any act, any crime. You simply passively allowed nature to take its course. You're clearly not obligated to put yourself at any risk of loss of livelihood and being thrown into jail for that kind of situation. And that situation plays itself over and over again every day in the hospital. So in the American context, if they have a DNR and it's a legal DNR, you do not have a chiyuv to intervene and to perform CPR on the patient.
You could carry it even one step forward. How come you don't walk by every emergency room and run in there every day when you're on your way home from work and see anybody here that has a DNR that's inappropriate? You're not mechuyev to do. The active is different than the passive. You would not be allowed to say, well, they want that tube removed, and my POSIC says I'm not allowed to remove it, then you're not allowed to do that.
Question number five, please. Okay, what
Shomer Mitzvot's woman, wife, who's been appointed proxy by her secular husband, and his living will contradicts her husband. What does she do?
The law allows her to contradict her husband anyway. As the proxy, you're not obligated to follow what a living will says. The proxy can make any decision that they want. I'll tell you that there is room then to fight the proxy legally, but the proxy has absolutely no obligation, and certainly if nobody's going to fight them, the proxy has absolutely no obligation legally and halachically, certainly not, to follow an incorrect halachic living will recommendation. So in that situation, I would strongly urge that she ask a posek, her posek. If her husband's secular, he obviously doesn't have a posek. So ask her posek what she should be doing, and she should follow what her heart tells her is right, which, by the way, many poskim would say that that's what the guy wants anyway, it's just that there's something preventing it. The Rambam has the classic example, Makoso, I'd show him the road sign there. You hit him until he says, yeah, that's what I want. How are you allowed to do that? Because that's what he really wants. The Eitz Sahara is preventing him from doing that.
There was a case in the United States. I don't remember the names. I remember Justice Ritholtz was the justice of exactly this. But there was a proxy who was deciding on a non-halachic basis for an elderly Jewish woman who was a religious woman, and the sister intervened and said this woman was a religious woman, and the proxy is not abiding by her wishes, and she actually got the proxy overturned through the legal system. It happened to be a Jewish judge who even mentioned the positions of Rav Moshe Feinstein about removal of care, and the proxy was removed, and her religious wishes were respected.
Ticket number six, please.
Is there enough room for another elephant?
Something that the panel talked about, namely that since most of the deaths today occur outside of the institute, we're faced with the DNH. DNH is not hospitalized, which is the insidious group that people are using to avoid the DNR and the DNI. Having been in the nursing home industry as medical director, you're faced with many families that use this to avoid this problem and to avoid the institutional problem, which most of the discussion is centered around. The donor hospitalized is a very difficult tool to avoid legal. And I think that a future discussion should evolve, especially with the advent of hospice, home hospice, and with the nursing home industry and people dying at home and getting sick and being taken care of home for long-term care. This is something that needs to be addressed in the long-term care. The second comment I'd like to make is that the comment that was made to me many years ago by Rabbi Scheinberg, the Torah Or of Yerushalayim, in a parallel meeting, we and a number of other physicians addressed the issue of when do we pull the plug, what do we do in the situation we've discussed here, as our colleague cardiology here talked about. And he put forth a principle which I think is something that we should think about seriously. That death is a process. It's not something that occurs in a moment. It's not something that comes in an hour in the emergency room. And it's something that we as physicians must develop sensitivity to understand when that process is inexorably moving forward. and near parallel cystotomy. At that point in time is a time that we should be able to withdraw ourselves from the scene or advocate withdrawal of the impediments, so to speak. I don't think the acute setting in the emergency room, an hour of evaluating patients, is enough for us as physicians to be able to understand what that process is. And I would urge us to teach our residents that this is not the time to make those decisions. And I don't think that in an hour of observing a patient, you can make a decision that this patient's not going to survive or will survive. You have to evaluate that process. In the home situation, in the nursing situation, it's more easier to do that.
The problem with that is, when I'm
have to make the decision, you don't have the luxury.
You're right, I can't decide if this patient's going to live, so I'm going to intubate them, and then they're going to be stuck with the symptoms, whether or not.
That's not our hands. We have, as physicians, we have a certain limited amount of power to do. We are not God, we can't predict. We have to do what the blood protocol told us to do, namely, we have to save a lot. And if we're not given the opportunity to understand what that process is, so be it. We do whatever we can to save that life, and then Dr. Ruff will sort things out also. What that patient that came to me, and an elderly woman, and the family was struggling with the decision whether or not to make it to do surgery, and hip fracture, parallel to the woman, just part of it. And in the decision process, no one mentioned the fact that there's a fresh book in this world. And he sends us signs and signals, etc. We just have to be sensitive to it. And when we go ahead and do things, and we have to do it with our limited understanding, eventually a fresh book will sort things out. And we as physicians have to understand that. So we do what we have to do, and in time things will sort out.
I don't think anybody's disagreeing with what you said.
No,
right.
But the DNA point is something that we have to totally avoid discussing, right. But it's something that's going to be the second element in the room as we go more and more into managed care, hospice, and long-term care.
The whole idea of creating a healthcare proxy when you're young and healthy is exactly meant to do that. And all of these decisions that we've been talking about halachically have nothing to do with the point of care. They're absolute. If you don't need to be intubated, you don't need to be hospitalized. If you do need to be intubated, then you need to be hospitalized. And if individuals wish to choose to ignore the halacha, unfortunately, that's part of Bechir Chavshi.
Families are putting forth DNH. Even, and it's not an absolute thing, but a person in the nursing home, the person goes into respiratory distress or they're putting kidney at 30 a minute. They don't need to be intubated at that moment. But you know and I know that an hour or two or a half a day from now, they may need to be intubated.
But that's the question. If your answer to that question, whatever it is, the answer to that question is they need to be treated, and then that's a halachic decision. Are you obligated to treat them, or is this one of those, you know, autonomy situations where some would say yes, some would say no? That halachic decision is no different in the nursing home, in the ED, in the ICU, or in a palliative care unit. The halachic decision is the exact same. The choice of the family to make the most optimal usage of their entire picture, do that when it's the best time to do it. You're right, in the ED it's a horrible time to do it. But the ED physician is under the rubric that when in doubt, save the life. And that's an overriding halachic parameter. So you're right, the ED physician is the wrong place to do it, but sometimes they don't have a choice. And that's why it's so important to know these halachic decisions before they happen and to try to figure out before they happen what you're going to do. And there's halachically a DNR, DNI, DNH, all halachically acceptable under the appropriate conditions. So I think you're very, very correct.
Could I add another elephant? Is that okay?
Okay.
One brief. The one very, very important aspect of this is even patients who are DNR, halachically appropriate to make them a DNR, the cultural milieu of American society is, and there's studies that back this up, that once a patient is made a DNR in a hospital, the therapy becomes much less aggressive. Nurses walk into the room less, physicians order less tests. So we, as Orthodox Jews, have to be very careful. When we do make a patient DNR, which is in many cases halachically appropriate, we have to be absolutely clear that it doesn't mean they should withhold all therapies. They should be very aggressive in other treatments, halakhically appropriate treatments, and many times the process can be reversed and the patient can be restored to good health. So it's one aspect of the culture of the hospital, which is absolutely essential that we understand.
One last question.
I just want one.
Okay, go ahead.
DNR does not mean do not treat.
Right.
It means do not resuscitate.
Okay, one last question, who does not have an elephant.
Right. One very small anecdote and a question for later discussion. The anecdote is that I spoke to the local rabbi one time about a patient who had a really painful, difficult problem. I dreaded treating him, but I thought there was going to be a chiyuv to treat. I called his posse, who said, there's no chiyuv to treat this man's problem. I said, thank God, I'm very relieved to hear that. Just for my education, on what grounds do you say that? So he said to me, well, I mean, that's different than the usual answer you get? So I said, well, actually, usually, I expect that the answer that I'm chiyuv to treat and go all the way. He said, well, you know, hold on there. Don't do anything. I'm going to get back to you in an hour. I'm just trying to show you. And he called back in an hour. You have a chiyuv to do everything. So this is an honest, true statement I stand here. My question for later is, could you panelists later, because it's a too complicated question, address the question of feeding tubes in patients who are going down the drain slowly, who have a problem with the nutrition, aspiration, chronic
misery,
and what are we obligating people to and their families to?
Difficult problems on the topic of feeding, lunch is across the streets right now.
I have a question.
And we resume at 6 p.m. There's Tafioni at 6 p.m. Or a second option is a talk by Soloveitchik on a new approach to stress death at 6 o'clock. Enjoy your afternoon.